Saj Issa is a Palestinian-American multidisciplinary artist living in LA. Traversing the rocky political terrain often attached to conversations over homeland, her work reflects on notions of displacement, dispute, and identity. Through assemblages of ceramic tiles, she pays homage to the heritage of Islamic craft. The intricate and ornate detailed designs jarringly subverted with logos of big oil or tobacco companies. The East meets the West. Or, maybe more accurately in this case, the West invades the East. Today, Evan Brico joins Saj at her studio in LA to discuss her forthcoming graduation, life as a Palestinian girl in St. Louis, Missouri, and the role of art in politics. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe to the channel, give us a follow on the socials. That's it. Enjoy the conversation.
And you were so kind to provide dates for this interview.
Yes, absolutely. I had to. Today's the first day of Ramadan, and that's my treat. I love to feed people my favorite brand of dates from Whole Foods.
We should say, and we should make it very clear, that we are also celebrating the end of your MFA show.
Yes.
On the campus of UCLA. So that is also slightly the occasion of this particular interview.
Yes.
I think. I don't know. So I guess the question is, how does it feel to like have the MFA show over with, have the work back in the studio, and kind of like, what, I don't know, like what, at what stage you're at with relief or direction?
So I'm in phase three of grieving, I think.
Sorry,
the first phase of grieving begins whenever the work leaves my studio. Okay. And then the second is the opening and having to, I mean, I love seeing people at the openings. I love, and I really appreciate people coming out, but I have social anxiety and having to say hello. I feel a sense of anxiety whenever I don't give the proper attention that I want to my friends and family that come in town for the shows. And colleagues. So that's phase two. And then phase three is whenever it's either back in my studio or still like in the gallery, but I've basically just kind of had this extremely overwhelming feeling of like not being able to fully process the work, but also, you know, just so your body's exhausted from putting in so much energy in the production. So there's a visceral feeling to just like want to collapse.
Do you have a go-to, like at an opening when like you're feeling like a little, when you're in stage two of grief, like do you have a go-to? Like a go-to like, okay, I'm going to leave the gallery space for 15 minutes. Like what's your...
You know, sometimes I wish I were a smoker to have the excuse to just like, yeah, what do you got in your pocket?
Social anxiety. I feel it.
That's my dad's cop-out move, is just like going out for a smoke every like 15 minutes. No, I usually designate one friend, like one really close friend I'll invite to the show and be like, hey, whenever I give you the look, I need you to come and swoon me and like act like there's something important to be taken care of.
Did they do that?
Yeah.
What did they do? What was the thing? What was the moment where they were like, they came in like, oh, I have this really important thing I need to discuss with you.
Okay. So it's my best friend, Laura Hamden from St. Louis. We grew up together, and she does an amazing job at like, she's a journalist. So she's really good with like communication and just like, I mean, her and I have this amazing telepathic communication where sometimes I don't even have to give her a gesture. She just knows. Openings are a strange thing. You know, whenever you dream and there's a lot of people from different parts of your life in the same room.
Right. And they sort of don't look like the people, they kind of have, they take on different, almost different appearances in the dream, but you know they represent something. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, that's exactly what it was like. It's like, yeah, this person that I went to high school with is here. This person from my undergrad college is here. This person I did this residency in Kansas City is here. Amazing people to all have seen, but it was just overwhelming for different parts of my brain to be activated and be like, oh my God, I can't believe this person's here. This feels very surreal. Also, my aunt, who I haven't seen in, you know, a year, is here as well.
So it was like a family affair.
Yeah.
When you've done exhibitions outside of like your MFA program or any of your grad school or any of your art schooling, like does it feel different that it's in the context of your MFA as opposed to just like an opening that's celebrating your work on its own?
Yeah, I think so. Like this was kind of like the most grander sort of opening, and a lot of people understood how important that was to me.
It's also LA, and it's like UCLA's got a great art art department, the history of the UCLA art department so strong. So like there's a lot of layers too.
Yeah. And then also the proximity to like graduation where people, you know, family do come in town for that. I was like, it's not important to come to a ceremony. It's more important to come to the show that I put this effort in, you know, with the work and such. And it's more fun too.
Didn't even realize the show was only a week long, and I'm so happy I went on a really, really rainy, floody day.
Oh my God, I appreciate that. That's amazing. Thank you.
The work itself, and you know, full disclosure, Saj was in a show that I curated a couple weeks before called The Weekenders. Shout out Guy Rusha in the gallery there.
Shout out Guy.
The work that you presented, there was like the mixed media ones with the ceramics and the painting.
Mm-hmm.
I was just absolutely enthralled by. I love those.
Thank you.
And I love what you were doing with the different textures and different materials. What like talk about what it is that you presented, because that work is really, really strong, and it felt there's a couple different things going on.
Thank you. I appreciate the sentiments. So it was a diptych painting of two storefronts that take place in Ramallah, the West Bank of Palestine. And in the same composition, there was this sort of flattened depth of this field or native flora that I decorated the environment with. And towards the top of the composition, I had inlaid hand-painted ceramic tiles that, and the pattern from that tile was also included in another piece adjacent to that room in the gallery. And yeah, what do you think? Did I describe it?
No, you described it really well. I was curious about how you source your materials for particular pieces like that. Is it based on photos that you've taken in Palestine? Is it based on, are the tiles based on traditional patterns? Like what is it that it went into those particular works?
I guess I should start off with the meaning of, or the title of the artwork, which is They've Changed the Signs. And the source of inspiration for the entirety of these paintings were my intention to depict Ramallah in a very idealized, romantic way, sort of without the chaos, without the noise, without the agony, and just...
Which came through, by the way.
Thank you.
It really did.
Wow, thank you. The title is sourced from this the concept of the street signs in the West Bank and how I've noticed that they changed in the past year. So I grew up going to Palestine every summer throughout my life, and I would pay very close attention to the street signs. You know, they were always labeled for as long as I can remember in order of Hebrew, Arabic, and English.
Hebrew, Arabic, English.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
This time the order of the languages was still the same, but I triple read the sign pointing to Jerusalem, which was, again, Hebrew, Jerusalem, English, Jerusalem, and then in Arabic, it used to be labeled Al-Quds, which is the way to identify the Arabic way of saying Jerusalem. But this time they've changed the transliteration to read Jerusalem. And it didn't stop with Jerusalem, it was every village in the West Bank. And the Arabic translations on the signs were previously colloquial names of the villages in Arabic. Now it's translated to phonetically spell the way it is identified in Hebrew. So again, Jerusalem is Al-Quds, now it's Jerusalem. Al-Khalil is now Hebron. And the village in which my family is from, Beitin, is now labeled Beitin, which refers to the settlement that's right beside my family's village. Those signs were depicted in the paintings.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that for most people listening to this podcast, which is international, we have an international audience, St. Louis, Missouri seems like the furthest place from Palestine I can possibly think on earth. Is that fair to say that seems like such disparate places? How did your family end up in St. Louis of all places? Which is the middle, like literally the middle of America.
Middle of America, and they're actually on like, you know, the north and south axis of the world, but that's like the east and west axis, like St. Louis, and then the other axis is Palestine. Wild.
Amazing, okay. So there's a draw.
I guess that puts it in perspective for others geographically, who many people in LA actually don't know where St. Louis is. Well, to be fair, Californians don't know where any of the Midwestern states are.
But the irony is that most people who live, I grew up in Oakland, California, so I'm a native Californian. I do know where St. Louis is. I could point it out on the map right now, but most people from California are actually from California, so you would think they would know where Missouri was.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. It's like its own little country on this side of America. Yeah, they don't know anything beyond like Nevada. Is it Nevada, Nevada?
I think you could go with either what. I say Nevada, but see, I don't know what my accent is.
I think we say Nevada and Missouri, Missouri.
Missouri, is it Missouri?
Missouri, yeah, that's okay. The way to say it.
So how did the, so?
So my parents.
Do you want to talk about it?
Yes, I do. It's really important. Okay. I love them.
It'll come full circle here. Well,
absolutely. Yeah. So my parents were born and raised in Palestine, and around like the 80s, during the first Intifada, is whenever my parents immigrated to America. And so I love hearing their stories of what they had to say America was like in the 80s versus what it is now. And I'm like, oh my God, like I wish I was alive at that.
They prefer the 80s.
They prefer the 80s. And if you asked, like if you get a poll of like just like 10 Americans, like who are above the age of 60 and ask, what was the best decade in America? Most of them will say the 80s.
I was born in the 80s, but don't have a lot of conscious memories of the 80s. So I would say the 90s, but like, I don't know.
So they basically immigrated to America. And the way that it usually, I guess, happens is one person from the village will get a job in a city in America, right? And then then another person will get a job at that, you know, convenience store, gas station, whatever, you know, point of interest they work at. And for my dad, it was a convenience store. And then they just settled in St. Louis. Like they didn't bother going to the coast like many other Palestinian families did, or pick a, you know, a more, I don't know, like affluent city like New York, or they just stopped at the middle of America. They're like, huh, this is cool. My dad likes to think of himself, and I see him as a cowboy too.
Okay.
And so that really appealed to him. Like there was a lot of, I forgot what the name of the show that was featured in Palestine, but a lot, it inspired a lot of Palestinian like men to want to be cowboys. And that was like the depiction of America. It was like, yeah, we smoke Marlboro and we ride horses and we have our cowboy hats.
Did your dad get a cowboy hat?
He did.
Yeah. Does he still have the cowboy hat?
I think so. He has several.
Okay. Several?
Yeah. Yeah. Because he's a gardener too.
Got it.
So there's gardening hats.
You also did undergrad in the area as well. So you spent significant amounts of time in Missouri. And where was Webster University?
In St. Louis. Okay. Yeah. So I studied, I earned my BFA at Webster University.
And what were you doing then? Like what was the motivation to go to art school and what were the things as a young girl in Missouri that you were into that got you into art school?
I think that for most people, it starts with like being good or talented in like drawing, painting, etc. And I was good at other disciplines too, but I was like really adamant about wanting to be an artist. And as corny as it sounds, it's very much so true. My first impression of what an artist looked like was Bob Ross.
And that should linger for many people.
I mean, I was like, I want to...
A gentle perm and a gentle voice.
Such a happy person. And then I see other people who are doctors and lawyers. I'm like, they're angry, but Bob is happy. Yeah. So later did I figure out that that was just an illusion, right? Being a happy artist. But yeah, so I've always had this interest in like craftsmanship, and it began with craft, I would say.
And then going back to Palestine enhanced that? Like the desire, interest, you know, the kind of understanding that craft was something that you could kind of work with?
Yeah, definitely. There was a lot of, I guess, like traditional folk art that I grew up seeing as well that inspired kind of the mediums that I work with today. I had this impression that like art can change the world. Still do have that impression.
It's not a bad way of looking at it.
Yeah. And so growing up in those two places that suffer the same sort of segregation and oppression really inspired me to like want to take action. And art was always a way for me to express that.
Did you feel the weight of the political situation when you would go to Palestine? Like, was it very palpable at that time? And continues to, I mean, obviously it continues to be extremely volatile in terms of the current political climate, especially the current this seems like this gentleman will not go away. But like, did you feel it when you would go back? I mean, I know the United States has its tensions, but that is a particular tension that is very palpable.
Yeah, definitely. It was interesting, like, seeing what, you know, the little instances of what occupation was whenever I was a kid, and then seeing the evolution of that change and get grander and bigger and more powerful and just this monster, you know. It was interesting, like, growing up and seeing how that system just keeps on evolving and becoming so ubiquitous, mm-hmm. It feels, because...
Yeah, but you could use, yeah.
Ubiquitous is the best term that I can use to describe all of these systems that are taking place. You know, it's not unique to just Palestine, but definitely has its fair share of oppression there, too much. And I'm always at a loss of words to describe what that looks like or what that is. And it's hard to explain. And I encourage a lot of people who want to, you know, be a tourist in either countries to just take a look at both sides.
Yeah.
Ubiquitous is a really good word to describe a lot of like what your work is about, aside from those two pieces that I was drawn to, of the kind of the street scenes of Palestine. But ubiquitous is definitely something that you play with iconography and logos and with the ubiquitous meanings of them, and you apply them to kind of a craft. I feel like that is something. Look, if you're going to put a Nike logo or a Shell logo on something so ornate that you're doing, like it's bold. What were the kind of first inklings of kind of dealing with ubiquitous iconography and presenting it in this way?
Yeah. So
that was a long-winded question, but there was something there.
It stuck. Something stuck with me there. Okay. I always like consider how logos can take form, and you know, depending on like the scale that they're presented, but whenever they're very small, they're design, right? Like, I mean, logos in general are design, but what I mean by that is it can be kind of plugged into the shapes of these geometric or floral patterns that I'm implying, and it kind of unsubtly looks very like it fits there. And that's the unsettling part about it, is that it looked like it always belonged there.
Yeah, well, what I liked, especially in this particular show that I saw, was that you had this ubiquitous sort of, and they are, like, they feel omnipresent. They're like, they're slightly aggressive logos because they mean something that's not necessarily the most fan-friendly, family-friendly, world-friendly logos. But then you kind of turn the corner and you saw these like very peaceful scenes that is actually based in an area of occupation. And I love that, I can't believe I'm gonna use this word, juxtaposition. There we go.
Sometimes there's no other words either.
We get dinged in the office if we use juxtaposition in an essay or anything, but whatever, we'll use it. It seemed like a very, very strong juxtaposition of sort of almost like this impending fear, but then like this calm in a place that is known to have so much resistance and challenges.
Right, yeah. So my choice of refraining from, you know, depicting any logos in the paintings itself was to kind of contribute to the idealism that I wanted to, you know, this love letter that I wanted to paint of Ramallah. And so I consider these logos as a hostile gesture, and that I integrate in these tile patterns. And so by refraining from doing so is like, okay, like it already feels so stuck and hard to have the tiles kind of ding, juxtapose in the composition, but it wasn't as ambivalent as including the logos. My choice of which brands make an appearance are based on which ones have made a critical impact in the East, such as Nike, Coca-Cola, LVMH brands, oil companies, and tobacco companies, or to name a few. And I've typically incorporated those in the form of ceramic tiles. And historically, tiles have been used in Islamic culture as a tool to represent divine principles of unity and order, as evidenced by God's creation of the universe. And so I utilized the traditional tile work combined with corporate logos as a way to draw connections between the ways that colonization seeps to the indigenous ways of life, both jarringly and obvious and woefully mundane ways.
Is it interesting then to see who buys the work?
Yes.
Knowing kind of what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Because it would be, I think they're really beautiful, but to have like a shell piece in your house, like that takes a very, very, like, it's an interesting purchase, I guess you could say.
I definitely agree. I think that...
I mean, I assume an oil executive is not buying it.
No, and I wish that they would. Why not, you know?
It would fit there.
Right?
Yeah.
I think that they're just so sick of creating this monster that they're like, oh, I don't want to live with it at home. Like, they recognize that. They're like, I don't want to have to... I don't think that they feel proud about it.
Right.
Yeah. You know, surprisingly, I did have one guy who works with Shell, came through my studio, and he got like a smaller kind of print. And I was in the process of making like the tile, like the large, you know, what is it, 60 by 96 inch tile work. And he was just like, whoa, like, he's like, you made it look beautiful. And I was like, that's the point. And he was like, it's so unsettling to see this.
There we go.
He admitted to it. He's like, it was a confidential conversation, but we were able to just talk about the way that, you know, somebody who works in that industry felt about the way that company, its contributions to society, mm-hmm. and then it conflating into someone's artwork.
Do you have to have two different mindsets when you are studying for your MFA and making work, but also having private sales and having a career outside of the school context? Is it difficult to manage or to two brains, or can it be the same?
That's a really good question. I prefer to have them both in the same place at all times. Yeah. I need as much as my brain as I can have in one room, but I think that I'm a realist, and to consider what, you know, the audience outside of the art world considers and thinks about, you know, my practice at least, and the conversations I want to have with those individuals, again, outside of the art world, is just a realist way to navigate. And oftentimes I think that in art circles, there's a lot of kind of floral language or lost in translation meanings and ideas that aren't realistic to expect others to engage with the artwork outside of this sphere. Like, I think that school and institutions are really nice to accommodate that for others that are willing to continue to just sit in that circle, the kumbaya circle of this is what art is, but others outside, it's, you know, for others outside, it's not as accessible. I prefer to have both of those.
Yeah, because like you do, you know, obviously as an artist, you want to make sales, you want to sell things in order to keep making stuff, but also you want to make sure that you can, the story of why the work is being made is also front and center. There's a balance.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there have been times where I was asked to commission certain works that were, again, didn't make sense to have, and I just won't succumb to whatever, you know? Right. That's, I have my boundaries with what I'm able to make sense in my practice, and others that I'm like, yeah, that makes sense, you know? But it's not random, and I don't want others to feel that it's random either.
Since we're here, and I didn't think about asking this, but I'm going to ask it, like, how is UCLA helpful?
Oh my God, it's the studio. Have you seen the studio?
I mean, it's just, yeah.
I haven't given you a proper tour.
But we'll get a proper tour, yeah.
So, sound like a student affairs like diplomat right now. UCLA's MFA program is the number one MFA program in America, right? In this nation. So the studio.
I want to have like the dean or somebody come in right now and be like, thank you so much for that. That was really, no, but it, I think because we're here and, you know, the history, obviously the history of UCLA, there's been so many people who've been in Juxtapose over the years who went, who've been part of this program. So that's why it's like nice to talk about the lineage, but also what, how it was helpful for what you were doing.
Oh my God, it's so amazing. The studios, I'm a studio-based artist, so these resources that I have here are super important. I'm gonna show you the ceramic studio and the amazing kilns that we have, you know, the wood shop, all of that. Like, it was a brand new facility at the time whenever I came into this program.
How long have you been in the program for?
So it'll be 2.5 years by the end of it. Yeah, so I came in, what is it, end of 2020? 2021 I started.
Really wonderful time for the world, by the way.
Wonderful time to live in LA.
That's what my girlfriend has said. It was actually, and I kind of was coming down here a lot in 20. It was a good time.
No traffic. I was able to drive from Malibu to Orange County in 45 minutes.
This is, you know, the thing about LA is that it's not a joke. People talk about the highways here. It's unbelievable.
What highways? There's only one. It's highway. East, west, north, south. That's it. but yeah, the facility and also the instructors in this program were amazing to work with and, you know, bounce my ideas off of. I feel like I was really challenged. And upon coming to this program, I really kind of surrendered to wanting to learn, mm-hmm. you know, the institution. But now I'm feeling like I'm ready to departure. I'm so, so ready.
But this is the thing, we were touching on is that you go in and you're like, all right, well, I have some attention outside of this. Like, I've sold some work and here I go. Like, you have to kind of like you just said, succumb to it and kind of like, I'm going to just use this to grow.
Yeah, definitely. I think that if you're wanting to go to school just to use the facility and not engage with your colleagues, classes, and kind of do the work there, then you're really not going to benefit that much. Like, you might as well work a job to suffice the studio practice outside of being in school. Like, part of it is, you know, the resources, but the other huge part of it is having the conversations with your colleagues. You know, like, there's a certain level, I would say from my experience, there's a certain level of like kind of concept that I'm able to have or talk about, discuss with people outside of the art world versus people, you know, an institution, let alone, like, let's neglect the galleries, right? The institution, we're able to really talk at length about, yeah. you know, research, history, art history, you know, politics, etc. There's a dead end with that.
Or
elsewhere.
When you came into school here, what kind of artist were you and how are you feel like you're leaving?
I think that whenever I started, I was a lot more confrontational. People say that I am a confrontational person, but I think that I'm a lot.
The work was confrontational?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The work was confrontational. And I think I am as a, you know, person that. But I've become a lot more subtle in the way that I want to communicate through art. Or I want to communicate those sort of confrontations through art instead of words now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like almost as if you are seeing that the confrontation is a life's work. So you don't need to hit somebody over the head and just one work every single time. It can be like a lifetime of
absolutely
depicting confrontation.
Yeah, I mean, I've learned so much about myself through just practice in general. And brain fog.
Do you have COVID?
I did.
My dad has COVID right now and he's just like in such brain fog. He's just like, oh, I don't.
I'm going to give you a list of supplements that I suggest for him.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. He's in the midst of it. So yeah.
It was, so I got COVID throughout in the middle of the program and that was really hard to work through. Like, I mean, you can't finish your sentences whenever you have COVID.
No, you kind of lose, and you like lose your confidence a little bit. Kind of just feel like a little bit like, it's dreary.
Yeah. I mean, I was able to run whenever I had the virus, but I couldn't think. I couldn't even read. I was like, what am I looking at? It's very strange. Rest in peace, COVID.
It's still happening, does it?
I guess so. Yeah, your dad has it.
Yeah, he's like in that period of time where it's like been like 3 weeks and it's just like, oh God.
Yeah, I'm definitely gonna have to give you that list of supplements that really helped me. But going back to what I was saying about what type of artist I was before this program. Yeah, there was a lot more weight on one artwork or the types of messages that I wanted to convey in one artwork. And I have a lot more grace with me and my practice now. And that was very helpful.
Yeah.
But I also understand the consequences that, gauging the type of consequences that what I produce might have on others.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel the weight of being a Palestinian American in the work?
Absolutely. I think that there's this pressure of representation that I want to be successful at, there's not a whole lot of Palestinian artists, especially ones that have the privilege that I have, thankfully. Like, I'm so thankful for all of the privilege that I was able to have going to school, being able to study art, and not worry about the financial kind of burdens that comes with that as much as other artists have. But I think that I don't want it to be all of me. Like, I don't want my identity to be all of what I make art about.
Right. Well, because then that will, do you feel like, because that will pigeonhole you for the rest of your career?
Exactly. Yeah. Anytime there's like, I'm going to sound like a narcissistic artist, but it's like, anytime there is a labeling or someone tries to box me in of like being a female woman, like all these shows that are like, hey, we want to include you in this like woman, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, or, you know, a person of color art show. Those are all great, but that's kind of stifling.
That's why we want to put you in a sports show.
I want to be the first to say this, but I actually want to be in a show with white men. Like, I want to be in a show with white men that make work about, you know, abstract expressionists or whatever white guys make work about. But but why can't we be in the same room together?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I will say that I feel like, what, I don't know if this is going to make it into the podcast, but what I feel like Juxtapose does a really good job of is it kind of mixes everybody together and just kind of like, we don't ever put like, oh, this is the same. Like, we never do that.
I love you guys for that. Yeah. It's art, kind of no strings attached, nothing, like none of that. It's, this is what it is.
Like, because it's always about, if you like abstract expressionism, you might like graffiti. You like graffiti, you might like what you're doing. Like, it's just like, because you don't have to just like one thing and just be like, well, that's it, I'm done. And I've done all my research.
And I appreciate whenever I do have the opportunities or people want to question the practice rather than making it about identity solely.
Yeah. One of the reasons why I really wanted to talk to you on the podcast was because I thought the way that you were mixing mediums was something I hadn't seen in a way that was that interesting. Like, I thought those paintings that you did, are they paintings? What do we call those? Because they're paintings with ceramic. What are they?
They are paintings. They're oil paintings on wood, and then I inlay ceramics in them.
Right.
So I do consider them paintings.
That must be heavy. Are they heavy?
Depending on the ratio of tiles that I inlay, yes. The kind of we got to look up a word instead of juxtapose.
No, let's keep using it because it's really good because it makes it, you know, it reiterates the title. People know exactly where they're at.
It really is. Just like these two mediums side by side kind of competing or comparing with each other.
You can say it that way too.
Yeah. Lengthy way of, yeah. It feels right. And what I found myself leaning towards, like, where I place the tile and the combination of the paint or the composition of the painting is particularly, and usually the sky, like where the sky would be in the composition is usually where I have the tiles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like that kind of effect. Was that a direction that you were already exploring before you got here? Or is that something that's developed since you've been here?
No, the tiles was entirely new. I've always had, kind of background in ceramics, and a lot of those skills just translated to tiles.
Yeah.
And I was a painter before I was a ceramic artist. And whenever I began this program, we didn't have access to our studios, so I had to literally make work in my apartment whenever I moved here. And it really just helped transition to from working three-dimensionally to flat.
Because you kind of had to.
Yeah.
You didn't have a choice. Yeah.
Space, and then also the toxicity of clay in my, you know, my home was not practical. So I was like thinking about like, how can I reference all of these kind of scenes and depictions that I want to in a flattened dimension? And the tiles and paintings was the way to do that.
What is something that you can tell me about St. Louis that has anything to do with the work that you make?
Okay.
That's a deep sigh.
Yeah.
We're not quite sure, everybody, guests or reader or listeners, if we're not quite sure if how excited she is about St. Louis, but we're going to get there.
I will explain to you why, but back to that question. My dad, again, whenever he immigrated here, he worked at a convenience store. And upon me moving to LA, I was just like, the convenience stores around and liquor stores and corner stores, they all felt ubiquitous in the area that I resided in at the time.
You had a body of work called convenience store, correct?
That's right. Yeah. And so I was thinking about these lack of portraiture portraits, you know, these kind of like quick transactions that are made at these places, but also the kind of how these places felt like a jewel box, and I wanted to portray that through a painting. And so there was a lot of kind of my father's background and my upbringing and, you know, his store that felt nostalgic, and these stores anywhere kind of carried that same vibe. That's a huge contribution of what St. Louis played into that body of work.
And like, is that where you kind of got the idea of like the repetition of logos?
It's ironically started with print first.
Oh, okay.
Again, I didn't have access to the studio, but I made these designs on my computer. I printed them out, and I wanted to make it into like a wallpaper to, again, reference like the tiles. And my instructor was like, don't take any shortcuts. Like, go make the tiles. And I was like, okay. She's like, you know how to do it. I was like, that's right. So I did. And that's 7-Eleven was the first one that I made.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And 7-Eleven being one of the, internationally, just being like ubiquitous upon ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially in LA. Like, there was like a few growing up that I'd witnessed, but they're like at every corner here. I was like, what's that about?
And I think the most interesting 7-Eleven I've ever been into, Tokyo has some interesting ones, but was...
I think it's Japanese, right? Like it started in...
It probably did.
7-Eleven?
But the one I went to, like some coastal town in Norway, was like the most... It was just like, I was like, this isn't 7-Eleven, but it is 7-Eleven, but it's not so... Because it was like the things were like just a little too nice in there, or like a little too like not on brand.
Oh.
It was like more like a grocery store.
You could sit down and have your coffee. It was a cafe in there. Yeah. Nice. What was the one in Japan like?
You could buy really good white t-shirts, which I like white t-shirts. So it's just one of those things with like,
That's convenient.
Very convenient. Could be too much information that might be cut out of the podcast. So that's where St. Louis comes in.
Yeah. Just like my upbringing, witnessing a lot of these male figures work in convenience stores and wanting to portray that through painting. But ultimately, like, the lack of figuration is still something that I'm interested in.
Yeah. That is refreshing.
Yeah. And alongside, you know, the tiles referencing Islamic art, lack of figuration is also kind of a move that I'm using to express that. And traditionally, Islamic law influenced abstraction and was unyielding towards artistic expression of figuration or any sentient being.
So you were in Islamic art, figures was not present.
That's right. Yeah. It was against the law to portray figuration. It was a way to remove society from, I guess, giving hierarchy or worshiping any idols or any persons, etc. So that's how the tiles and the kind of geometric, phenomenal patterns derived. Phenomenal, is that a word?
I liked it.
Thank you.
You know, the irony is with the lack of figuration in like a more of a gift of abstraction would actually, to me, make people think of out. It's almost seemed more anti-authority to have abstraction.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it seems kind of like a weird
OG graffiti.
Yeah, it kind of seems like it seems counterintuitive to like what the law would be, but I understand why. I understand in the context of the history of Islam why it's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
But abstraction always seems to be like anti-rules.
I think that it was also to, again, not give entitlement or power to one being.
Yeah.
But ironically, what happened was over time, whenever mosques or religious sites, architectural like palaces, etc., were established, it was under the name of like an emperor or ruler or whatever. And it's like still like there's still this authoritarian figure that was either a funding or, you know, establishing an architectural site to pay homage to that being.
Yeah.
You can't escape it.
You can't escape it. Yeah.
I would say like my artistic practice is informed by the style of craft, which is, you know, very intricately adorned, which results in the work being detailed, abstracted, and geometry and the florals. And there's a couple things that I want to say about, I guess, the lack of figuration and the way that has portrayed itself in the Middle East. The lack of figuration presented in the Muslim world allowed for non-Europeans and non-Muslims to depict Arabs and their society with their artistic egocentric expressions. And so this took place before the 19th century of Orientalism. Going to Palestine and seeing a lot of these like religious biblical sites, there's a lot of like depictions of white Jesus. And my theory is that the Romans had that leverage and stride over the Muslim world to depict Jesus because of, again, the law of removal, you know, right. Removing, depicting figuration. It's really kind of crazy to go to the Middle East and then see the same white Jesus that I grew up seeing in Missouri and in Bethlehem.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
It doesn't add up.
No.
I just thought of this. Hold on if this doesn't go anywhere, but are you playing with the idea that the Western world went into the Middle East, gave a white Jesus? Are you playing with the idea that now this iconography is where I'm throwing it back to the Western world in an Eastern way? Back? Like it's almost like a conversation like, so you need Jesus white, I'm gonna do Nike in a traditional Arab, you know, kind of aesthetic.
That is really interesting to think about. Wow. That's brilliant.
Thank you.
I'm going to write that down on my table. Not even my notebook, my table.
She's actually writing this down.
Thing.
She could also just listen to the podcast in a couple of days. And
I will forget. It's fresh in my mind.
When did you design your logo?
So my logo was designed by a student at WashU. Yeah, she was a graphic design student. And at the time I was like, I graduated with my BFA and I thought that I knew everything about everything. And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna be a studio potter for the rest of my life. I don't know, I probably got through like the 200th pot and I was like, fuck this, I'm not doing this for the rest of my life.
Cause you could always do that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I was like, I just wanna like make work, you know, pots and sell them online. And that was like going very well. But anyway, I really wanted a potter's mark that would encapsulate like the identity of me and through typeface, while also having some sort of symbol that would reference my name in Arabic. And so it's read in English, Saj, and connected to the J is the letter S in Arabic. So that's how my logo came.
It's a dope logo, by the way.
Thank you. She did phenomenal. And yeah. I actually paid a couple other, whenever I like got more money, I was like, you know what? Let me see if I can like rebrand the logo. I paid some other graphic designers to, and they did not do it justice. I was like, nah, I'm leaving it.
What is the thing that makes you the most excited about being done with your MFA?
I'm in stage three of grief right now. That's a hard question. But I think that the liberty to travel without having to worry about classes, like I can just, it feels really surreal to be able to just pick up and travel now.
What is like the first thing on the bucket list as this is over?
Sicily.
Why Sicily?
One, you know, White Lotus kind of.
Oh, really? Is that what it is? I haven't watched season two yet, so I really apologize to everybody who's probably listening, just like you've, how did you not?
Yeah, Sicily looks like what paradise would be. You know, paradise, you imagine it and it's Sicily. I want to go to Sicily. I also want to spend a few months in Palestine. So I'm going to be kind of in that region of the world. Yeah. It feels a lot easier to travel around kind of. I'm going to also go to Europe as well. It feels like once you're on that side of the continent or the that side of the world and those continents, it's like easier to get around.
I think I've never been to Sicily, but I have Italian family in southern Italy. Feels a little bit like where my heart is. So I definitely, when I was there, I was like, oh, this is probably it. This is where home felt like. What is the next couple months look like? Do you have shows? Do you have anything lined up?
Not on the record that I could share with you.
Okay, well, that's fine.
Yes, but
that means something. So that's
at the moment I'm working on like more writing, and there's this collaborative book called The Watermelon Book that I'm working on with my friends. So I want to kind of submit a 20-page creative artistic expression through printed matter. So I'm excited to explore that because I'm so material based. So that's next on my list.
Do you want to do your last pitch for UCLA Art Department, or are we?
Yes.
What is your last pitch?
Okay, like just okay.
Yeah, this is the pitch. Look, we're doing a podcast, and I'm a former UC student, so I feel kind of a kinship. So
what UC did you go to?
Santa Cruz.
Oh, okay. Did you like it?
I did.
You got to put that. Yeah, UCLA.
At least you guys have a basketball team.
Yeah. Yeah. And a football and et cetera. I love the school. I'm so grateful to have the privilege of studying here. And if anyone is interested in applying to UCLA and has any questions, ask me 6 months after I've graduated.
Yeah, this is premature.
My experience. But I'm very grateful and privileged to have studied at one of America's top leading MFA programs.
Is LA home?
No.
No?
No.
Do you know where home is, Gordon?
Not yet.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, not yet.
No, you shouldn't have that answer.
I'm looking for it though.
But what did you get from Los Angeles? Like, what was the...
So much, oh my God. The art community here is so generous and so friendly. I thought that it would be very competitive before coming here, but it's actually more competitive in St. Louis. I mean, there's, you know, way more art opportunities here. No one's kind of like feeling like there's a certain amount of spots at the table. So that's cool. And overall, just like meeting more people from like the international world has been very amazing to be a part of.
Would you spend more significant time in Palestine if you could?
Absolutely. I only have, if I'm lucky, a 3-month visa. But yeah, actually I will share what I'm gonna do after I graduate, yeah. I wanna spend some time there making art, and I've never done that. I've only gone there, visited, experienced, and then took all that information back to America and made work. But I want to physically make that at the ceramic studios there, as well as like my home, my parents' home. So I'm excited about that.
Okay, that's...
You could tell us that.
Well, there was this other opportunity that I'm excited about that I just had to keep close.
thank you for today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Congratulations on stage three of grief.
Thank you. I think this is helping me get through stage three.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Oh, see?
Thank you so much for coming and taking the time to learn about more about me and my practice.
Yeah, we'll have to do an update when you get back from Palestine, if after making work, for sure. Thank you.